13. Tours and JJRTC. The Tours Division, a part of Secret Service Special Operations Section, allows everyone from American tourists to Arab potentates to see and experience the White House and to inhale its storied history. I wanted in. Even if it wasn't my original career goal, it was the next best thing and a promotion and honor in itself. Most important, it would get me away from the Oval Office. Absorbing the incredible amount of history necessary to become a competent tour officer is daunting, and it seemed impossible as far as my capabilities went. The UD officers who ran tours knew every factual smidgen about the White House. They could tell you fascinating stories of great leaders and world wars, or get into details as seemingly minute as who made the floors, where the wood came from, why it was chosen from other kinds of woods, and more. They could go for hours about a specific set of drapes, and each window has drapes, how they were chosen by which FLOTUS, and how some important decision was made right there on that spot. They were walking encyclopedias of our presidents, first ladies, first families, first dogs, the whole sweep of American history, and how it flowed through those hallowed grounds. How could I ever master that? My dyslexia and ADD were things I couldn't keep secret for long, I knew. I worried that failing my initial tours testing and training, if I ever got that far, might reveal my learning disabilities to other placements. But Jenny never gave up on me, or let me give up on myself. She was my savior. Each day when I came home, she grilled me on what I needed to know. Fortunately for me, the test was oral. The final test was 2 hours of stress and pain, but simple, and it reflected whether you could do the job. You'd give a tour to the other White House tours officers, answer their questions as if they were expert visitors, and if you did it right, you passed. Quite the novel idea. If you could do the job, then you could do the job. That being said, I failed the tours test more than once. Things grew tense, but the guys could tell I was a people person and how much I wanted this, so they gave me another chance at passing their very high standards. They didn't want me to fail, but they were not about to compromise the tour's mission either. To them, it was about preserving American history. The White House depended on it. With each test tour and practice with Jenny, I found that she had ingrained herself into every detail of the White House. When I saw whom I was giving the tour to, it was as if I were giving the tour to half a dozen Jennies. That helped to keep my nerves from pouring out of my stomach and having to replace yards of carpet, particularly historic White House carpet. I have a strong constitution, but not a strong stomach. Suddenly, everything clicked. It seemed that as soon as the tour started, I blinked, opened my eyes, and we were at its merciful end. I had the job. Finally, I had largely escaped from the Oval Office, departing my full-time duties there in autumn 1997. My American dream was evolving. I looked forward to my new normal. Around Christmas time 1996, I was officially transferred to tours. Such a grand feeling. The White House staff outdid itself just as it did for all major events. The White House Easter egg roll, New Year's, Thanksgiving, Independence Day. Its members never slept. They knew how important they were to the White House and how important the White House was to the nation. For me, the Christmas celebration was almost as giant a cause for celebration as it was when I made tours. I often found myself standing in front of a window looking out on D.C., the snow falling on the park, seeing our booths covered in snow and the booth creatures, and marveling at how lucky I was to be one of them, an officer of the Uniformed Division and the U.S. Secret Service, and how lucky I was to be here at Tours. And by the way, with a burn baby in the works, the incredible amount of overtime that came with the holidays was very welcome. Oh yes, sometimes it was stressful. A simple mix-up of words can set dominoes into motion that lead to front-page headlines and national embarrassments, but I wanted to be back under the radar. I readied myself for a very big tour escorting the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. I was honored that management selected me. As I left the break room, a UD Tours friend of mine warned me not to screw up, but actually, he ensured that I would. Above the fireplace in the state dining room on a mantel is a quotation cut in marble, a prayer from John Adams after he had spent his first night in the executive mansion. During the NAACP prayer, I recited the prayer aloud from memory, just as I had to hundreds of groups. Only this time it came out, "I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessing on this house and on all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and white men ever rule under this roof." One of the NAACP members leaned over to me. "Does it really say white men in the White House prayer?" I stopped the tour. Red-faced, I asked if I had indeed made the mistake. I had. I told them how mortified I was, and then explained the story of how a friend had tried to trip me with his joke, and how I had actually tripped, and that the term I replaced was wise men. I stopped breathing, waiting for their response. I could see an avalanche of user-friendly sensitivity training hurtling our way. This was the blue glove incident on steroids. I didn't laugh, but thank God they did. Imagine the New York Times headline, "Racist Secret Service Guard Insults NAACP Delegation," or "Are All UD Officers Racists?" The big, historic wooden door of the White House would hit Officer Gary Byrne on his way out. Old friends would distance themselves from me. The agency would paint me as a bad apple they had promptly kicked out of the barrel. Fortunately, the NAACP members had a great time and thanked me for my tour. I guess they had their own workplace humor. No ado was made of it, although I'd seen much ado made over smaller things. I get goosebumps just thinking of it. I had seen the NAACP when I'd been posted outside the Oval Office. The president, Al Gore, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and other NAACP officials entered the hallway. The various reverends decided we should all pray together, and before I could weasel away, the next thing I knew, we were all holding hands and bowing our heads. Was I supposed to bow my head or stay alert, on guard? An agent too far away to get suckered in snickered at me, and later said he knew I'd never stop getting crap for it. Dear Lord, while at Tours, I got a call from a friend at my home from his home phone. "The Oval Office logbook is new, Gary. Just a heads up, Ken Starr's investigation subpoenaed the old logbook," he said. We talked about it for a while. "Thanks for the heads up," I told him, and we knew what we were in for. We were screwed. Maybe, just maybe, everything would go away and leave us alone. But the Clintons couldn't help themselves. They couldn't keep their hands out of the cookie jar. Despite having such a great man as Leon Panetta as his chief of staff, President Clinton insisted on having outside, unofficial dealings with the shadowy political figure and pollster Dick Morris, whom you now see peddling retirement plans on TV infomercials. After the White House wound down for the day, I and other UD officers on the late-night rotation would occasionally allow Morris, a close friend of Hillary, in for unofficial policy meetings. It placed the Secret Service in yet another delicate position. Morris was essentially a Republican. He'd worked for GOP Senate leader Trent Lott. The Clintons snuck him in by night, never by day when Panetta was there. We didn't quite comprehend that Hillary was undermining Panetta, and we certainly couldn't insert ourselves into these mysterious visits to sort out their true meaning. Morris, the Clintons called him Charlie to hide his visits, Bill and Hillary met frequently, mostly in the executive residence, though once Bill and Morris met alone in the Oval Office. It all translated into Dick Morris's functioning as President Clinton's shadow chief of staff, blindsiding Leon Panetta on issues Panetta thought had previously been decided. Over the course of the first 9 months of 1995, no single person had more power over the president, George Stephanopoulos later concluded of Morris. Hillary could not readily intrude on her husband's official meetings with Panetta, but she could easily participate at these intimate, secret sessions with Morris. Her true power was of the night, not the daylight. Increasing Morris's power meant increasing her power. But these hush-hush meetings weren't so much about governing as they were about branding and politics and polling. And Dick Morris and Hillary Clinton were masters at that game. I found confirmation of it all in Leon Panetta's autobiography, Worthy Fights. Unbeknownst to me, Clinton had been secretly reaching out to political advisor Dick Morris in an attempt to take stock of the nation's politics. Clinton surely sensed I didn't like Morris. He was right about that. So even though Morris started doing polling on the very issues the White House staff was working on, Clinton didn't share the results or even the facts of the polls with me. It was actually Hillary Clinton who had asked Morris to resume working for the president. The Clintons admired Morris, who openly disdained the substance of policy. He was about winning. So the Clintons were sneaking around the ablest assistant they ever had, Leon Panetta. Then again, President Clinton was good at sneaking. While at Tours, I still felt I needed to put an even greater distance between myself and the debacle the presidency had become. By now, I had lost my ability to provide these professional scandal makers with any benefit of the doubt. Eleanor Mondale and Monica Lewinsky could not satiate the president's horndog sexual desires. There were many others. I saw plenty of awkward run-ins and drama with other officers and staff. President Clinton had difficulty managing where he saw his many mistresses, whether it was at the White House or on the road. It baffled the uniformed division as to how he could manage all these women without any of them realizing there were so many others. We wondered how he got any work done and joked that he would have been better at running a brothel in a red light district than the White House. And why didn't the president's staff and supporters believe Paula Jones's allegations of sexual harassment? Why did they take the president at his word about his other sexual scandals when they knew he was a cheater? But his luck was bound to run out. He had lit too many fuses, and I knew that at least one was sure to explode in his face. The Clintons had attained the White House by manufacturing an image of being bright, shining stars who cared deeply for the little guy. The truth is, they wallowed in mud and were willing to drag numerous little people with them to retain power. Over the radio around dusk, December 6, 1997, I heard that Monica was at the Northwest Gate. I shook my head. Here we go, I told myself. The president was having a private session at the White House. Monica visited on the pretense of seeing Betty Curry to have Betty convey a number of Christmas presents to the president. By this time, every single person in the White House, except perhaps the First Lady, knew the deal between Monica and the president. The Northwest Gate officer, a friend of mine, wouldn't let her in. Betty had instructed them to delay her entrance. Everyone had already heard of my awkward run-in with Eleanor Mondale in full display with the president in the map room and the library room. We knew the score. The president is still with another appointment, or something to that effect, was what Betty informed the Northwest Gate officer. Normally, if someone was scheduled to see the president and he was running late, a pretty normal occurrence, they'd be let in to wait in the West Wing lobby. But the White House didn't employ Monica at this point. I wasn't involved in her being transferred to the Pentagon in July 1996 or swept under the rug by her mentor, but if I could have dragged or kicked her off the premises, I would have. By now, Betty and the gate officer knew enough not to let Monica on the White House grounds at all. She could stay in the security booth, but she was not allowed beyond that. She was left standing. Still, the president signaled to her that she was welcome, and she visited by scheduling appointments with Betty. She would have been welcome that night, except for the president's conflicting engagement. Somehow, whether through the president's top-secret military staff or through trusted employees, Monica had remained in contact with the president and Betty. It was only around 5 o'clock on a weekday. A normal person would assume the president would still be working, but it wasn't so. I don't know how Betty felt about it, but the president put her in a hell of a jam. The Northwest Officers Initiative was part smart decision and part unofficial protocol quietly backed by Secret Service upper management. He told Monica she couldn't enter and had to wait. In our minds, Monica never had a job beyond mere busy work. She hadn't been a real employee before and had been transferred across the Potomac. And everyone knew why. She was only the president's mistress, as far as we were concerned, and we didn't appreciate being part of the president's nonsense. Monica, however, still regarded herself quite favorably as the president's singular mistress. So now she was pissed off. She pressed the officer about the delay and wanted to know why she was left standing in his security booth. He lashed back. "You have to wait. He's with his other piece of A. Wait till he's finished," the officer said, or something to the same effect. That was not the answer she wanted. She became irate when she heard whom the president was with. "What's he want with her when he has this?" And she made some gesture to herself. The officers relayed the story to me after and how incredibly awkward it was for them. UD screens for dangers, but this was a constant hazard of the president's own making. I kept thinking, please don't let her up. Betty, the Northwest Gate officer, and everyone had the right idea. Inevitably, the president was going to get his meetings crossed up and there would be a wild domestic dispute. The first lady was typically either one floor up in the West Wing, in the executive mansion, or just walking around. But that wasn't the only problem. The president and Betty had a different take. The problem to them wasn't that they now couldn't keep his mistresses in line and safely separate. Someone in UD had leaked to one of the mistresses, Monica, that the president was meeting with another mistress. I received a call from my watch commander. He wanted my opinion about how high this incident would blow. But who could tell in this topsy-turvy world of the Clinton White House? One thing I knew. These Northwest Gate officers were protected by a fear of mutual self-destruction on the part of upper management. Management couldn't discipline them without formally detailing the issue in writing, and nobody wanted to do that. But that was only half the game. Would the UD and Betty start finger-pointing at each other? Or worse, somehow at me? Betty Curry wasn't the real problem. The Northwest Gate officers weren't the real problem. Monica wasn't the real problem. The real, the massive, the central problem was Bill Clinton. That being said, after everyone had simmered down and thought things through, we felt terrible for Betty. I even felt bad for Monica, because I knew how powerfully charming President Clinton was. He was the master. That charm can't be fully understood or described unless you've seen it. Unless you've been in the same room with the man. He's incredibly endearing. I saw the effect he had on people. I was glad to have moved off my main posting. Ken Starr turned up the heat. Subpoenas for logbooks and people started flowing like an errant stream. After just a year at Tours, I put in for a transfer to the Secret Service's James J. Rowley Training Center, JJRTC. In 1998, my transfer was quickly approved, much faster than I had any right to expect. No doubt Monica and Bill had something to do with that. I was a thorn in their side. Now I was gone. My commute was much shorter, and I was back in Beltsville, Maryland. I had landed a spot on the security detail for the JJRTC, a 660-acre mix of dense woods, swamps, fence line, interstate highway, dynamic firearms ranges, indoor ranges, and office buildings. We secured the grounds and the facility. This even included taking care of the beaver and poacher problems JJRTC was having, in addition to dealing with any infiltrations, police issues, reporters, panicky people, and the like. It was a great job. I immediately fell in with the team. Much of my stress was gone. Life was simple. No burn bags, no special towels, no seedy interns. Just the facility, good people, and Maryland woods. It was just like Air Force security police. The year was 1998. I liked my job immensely, along with the woods, the clean air, and no more colds and office bugs going around. My sinuses cleared up. It was as if I could smell for the first time. I was free from all the stress. I didn't throw up anymore. I slept better. When I awoke, my sheets and pillowcases were no longer drenched in sweat. I had put in for my real dream, to become a JJRTC firearms instructor. My life was firearms, and what better way to fulfill my dream than by passing on my passion to others? Firearms clicked with who I was. They made sense. It was the one thing I wasn't just good at, I was extremely good at. I should have been a shoo-in, and I waited for a spot to open up. I'd only been at JJRTC a couple of weeks when my dreams of a normal life vanished as quickly as they had appeared. My calm wasn't a calm at all. I was in the eye of the biggest storm the presidency had yet witnessed. It was the night of January 17, 1998, and two supervisors and I had crammed into a Chevy Tahoe for a road trip to a nearby military base, Fort Dix, New Jersey, hoping to obtain some extra ATVs and light vehicles to assist in our patrolling duties. We had just left the fort's surplus site after tagging some equipment and were flying 85 miles per hour down the New Jersey Turnpike in our unmarked federal vehicle, listening to the Howard Stern show on the radio. Stern started talking about a media leak website called the Drudge Report. It was a million laughs until my blood ran cold and I almost drove off the road. Stern was telling us about a White House intern turned Pentagon intern turned paid White House employee who had been having an affair with the president. They mentioned oral sex, the Oval Office, and the Secret Service. The Drudge Report had broken the story of the president's cheating and lying, his lack of professional integrity, and how he lied on a legal affidavit. Newsweek had the original scoop, but didn't have the guts to publish it. Everyone knew the Drudge Report had credibility. I knew immediately this was going to be a disaster involving everyone, that it would tear apart the Secret Service, and maybe the nation itself. I knew it would involve many of my friends and me. The public would rip at us the way a dog tears a toy to get at the squeaker. As Howard spoke, I knew that I alone could prove the president had lied on a sworn affidavit and committed an impeachable offense. I flipped out. I pounded the dashboard. They had to stop the car so I could get out and vomit. Back in the car, I talked about it with my superior. He brushed it off as not a big deal. He advised that if I was asked about it, I should say I didn't remember. I couldn't recall. We kept listening and we kept talking. And he soon realized how poor that advice was. Cooking at 85 miles per hour on the New Jersey Turnpike, which feels like you're driving down a lit-up runway for miles, he asked, "Well, what do you think you should do?" I wanted him to contact the chief and get the ball rolling down the chain of command so that we could get ahead of this thing. The uniformed division was a tight-knit group of about 1,000 strong, and we had a policy of talking it out whenever possible rather than leaving a paper trail. We rushed back to Beltsville so we could make the call. Forced by the Starr investigation, the president was to give testimony on the Paula Jones case any day now. Somehow Matt Drudge and his website received a leak. In response, the president had signed a subpoenaed affidavit, legally sworn testimony denying any sexual relations with Paula Jones, the low-level Arkansas state employee who had accused him of sexual harassment, and more so, any relationship with Monica Lewinsky. He said they didn't have any contact with each other, hadn't even been alone in the same room together. He swore to it and said others could corroborate. Monica Lewinsky signed another affidavit. Ken Starr had been following the Clintons like a bloodhound. But at each turn of each scandal, Whitewater, Vince Foster's suicide, Travelgate, Filegate, the affairs, the bribes, Troopergate, and more, it all came down to deny, 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 and the Clintons' word against everyone else's. Only this time, Clinton arrogantly denied his affair with Monica on a legal affidavit, sworn testimony. The shit was hitting the fan. Ken Starr now needed to prove Clinton was a liar, a perjurer. He needed evidence. Since they subpoenaed our logbook, I knew I was on Starr's list. I couldn't listen. I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't drive anymore. My partner asked me what was wrong. I can remember the feeling, my heart racing, my mind whirling, racked with pain, doubt, remorse, and regret. Oh my God, Starr, the Clintons, the service, the FBI, the Justice Department, my friends, my family. No, not my friends and family. But everyone is going to implicate me, my integrity, my professionalism, my ethics, my foundation, my character. What about Jenny and my unborn child? I didn't sign up for this. We never signed up for this. Why did the Clintons have to do this to us? Haven't I treated them well, done my best? They just couldn't do the right thing. They couldn't stop themselves. And we couldn't help them save themselves. We couldn't stop them from embroiling us either. They had embodied the hopes of their generation. How do you do that to your supporters, your constituents, your believers? It took me a good hour and a half to finally get home. And when I did, I talked to Jenny briefly. She had already heard the news. We agreed that we'd have to see how the next day played out. I needed to blow off steam and went for a run. She understood. I returned with my head on straight. The chief of the uniform division had called. The chief. I couldn't believe it. I called right back. I had warned my lieutenant that my situation was about to blow sky high and that the agency had to take the matter seriously. At first, he hadn't believed me. But later, he went around the chain of command to alert our superiors. I hadn't expected his call to travel so far and so fast, but clearly, we were all worried. Gary, first off, before you say an effing word, don't tell me any information, because they'll subpoena me and it's just going to make it harder on you and everyone else. I don't want to know why you're calling, because then I may have to corroborate later. But I'm going to put you in touch with the service's lawyers. You're not the only officer involved. Hang tight and they'll contact you, got it? My chief had been around a long time. I respected him immensely and hoped that he really did care and would back me up. He had been a UD officer, then became a special agent and then head of the UD. He knew the job from the bottom up and led from the top down. I hung up and looked at Jenny. We exchanged blank stares. My dream of becoming an instructor or even staying and working the security detail at JJRTC, my entire career, my income for my family and our unborn child were in jeopardy. I waited in silence for a call back. 14. Mud Drag, Part 1. I, Officer Gary J. Byrne, received my first Justice Department subpoena. Word went out that Ken Starr had found fired staffers from the White House and had an axe to grind. Some of them dragged me into the investigation. I've often wondered who gave me up. I believe the reason the Starr investigation targeted me was that they knew I was nobody's stooge. I had my hunch it was a certain press lobby staffer whose passes I pulled from him. He was subsequently kicked out of the White House for insulting an officer. I'd had him removed. What I did surmise much later from both the Secret Service grapevine and from news reports was that because I had knowledge of Bill and Monica, I had been outed to the papers and to Starr by at least one colleague, the Silver Fox. That's what we called Louis C. Fox, the first of the subpoenaed servicemen. The Silver Fox was a great guy, and in many ways had ushered me into my Oval Office posting. He was a cop's cop. When I first met him, he was among the crew's more experienced members. With his mane of pure silver hair and innate charm, he looked like the most interesting man in the world from the Dos Equis beer commercials. The Fox had retired by 1998, but had served at our postings and was right there for much of Billary's dramas. Being retired and a bachelor, he didn't have the strings others and I did. I found out that the Fox was having dinner with friends at a bar when the TV reported the Drudge Report leak, the same story I heard while barreling down the New Jersey Turnpike. The Fox told his buddies something like, "Oh, you guys don't know the half of it," and proceeded to tell people what he'd seen. He didn't reveal any secret info, and since he was retired, nothing he said was considered privileged, as it was for me. His monologue was the talk of the joint. He went on to say that the guy they should see is Gary Byrne, because Gary'd had the most run-ins with Monica and the other women, and could blow the president and his cohort's affidavits wide open. Legend has it that a friend of a reporter was in that bar and used the diner payphone to call his buddy. It's a small and dangerous world. The papers were hunting the Fox even before Star was, but the bloodhounds soon closed in. Somehow they caught my scent along with his. It was the Fox who first went on record, claiming that he had seen Monica and the president in the Oval Office alone together for 45 minutes. Hardly stopped the press's news, until the president responded to Matt Drudge's leak by saying Monica and he had never been alone in a room together. President Clinton had exclaimed that all the reports were absolutely false, the ones about her actually being a paid mistress, on top of other illegal, risky, and unethical activities that I knew had occurred. The story circulated through TV, radio, the papers, and that relatively newfangled thing called the internet. I knew shit was avalanching downhill, and I was in the valley below it. Starr sent subpoenas to the Secret Service Headquarters Legal Counsel's office, and I was notified of mine. "Hang tight, Gary. We'll deal with this," they told me. With the Justice Department heading the investigation and filing the subpoenas while playing both sides, I felt legitimately outgunned, the way a lawyer might feel in a gunfight. This wasn't my turf, and everyone might as well have been speaking Greek. I hung tight, but worried that I'd be hung out to dry, like my fellow UD officer Hank O'Neill. The lawyers were going to legally stonewall the subpoenas. Though they were addressed to the USSS office, the subpoenas were for myself, not the Secret Service. As far as I was concerned, Secret Service meant secret, damn it. We were not in the business of telling anyone what we saw while on the job. Secret Service personnel had never been subpoenaed previously, but I thought if I was, I would be granted immunity. It could be perceived that I was committing obstruction of justice, but the FBI was targeting not just the Secret Service, but the Clintons. Everything was all very political, and the difference between stonewalling and obstructing depended on which side you were on. While the FBI felt I was illegally obstructing, the service considered my actions appropriate. The service's lawyers thought that their stalling tactics would work as they filed endless appeals. I just wanted to concentrate on my job. After several subpoenas ended up in my circular file, I was yanked off my JJRTC security detail and told to come in for a briefing by the Secret Service's legal heavyweights. The Justice Department played both sides like a fiddle. For the offense, Ken Starr was appointed in August 1994 by Attorney General Janet Reno. President Clinton had appointed Reno. For the defense, she also appointed Gary G. Grindler to represent the Secret Service against Starr. Grindler and Starr duked it out, with officers like myself caught in the middle. I spoke often with Jenny. Our talks were straightforward and serious. We sorted out our life's goals, what we could expect from the legal process, and that we couldn't avoid it, and how we would go through it. She stuck with me. She was carrying our first child. The legal system was about to slice and dice her husband, but she always told me to do the right thing. She was my rock. I never had to worry about leaving the shit at work to meet the shit at home. Home was sanctuary. I just never wanted to disappoint her, or our expected baby. JJRTC leadership thoughtfully allowed me to use a federally marked Tahoe so I could avoid DC parking issues. I could at least be spared one aggravation. Each morning I drove from the shitbox, what we affectionately called our rental home while our new home was being built for our growing family, to JJRTC in Beltsville. Then I drove to the Secret Service's DC headquarters, just a block from the White House, though I couldn't park there, nor did I want to. At first, I just wanted to tell my story and get the hell out. But the first week turned out to be a mind-bending experience, as the Secret Service attorneys told me how complicated this was going to be. They had no fiduciary duty to me, and this worried me. I enjoyed none of the confidentiality privileges normal in an attorney-client relationship. They were loyal to the government, but more specifically, to the service. Anything I told them was going to be shared with the service, and in one way or another, with my leadership. They warned me that this was going to be a long, drawn-out process. They explained my rights, and I was surprised that my rights needed so much explaining. I felt incredibly demoralized. I was told that I could never reveal information that might jeopardize the safety and security of the president. That was non-negotiable. They explained to me that information needing security clearances required separate and individual subpoenas. They advised me that I could never buckle under pressure. Never, no matter how hard the star people pressed or insisted, was I to surrender information regarding the president's movements, our standard operating procedures, the secret layouts of the White House, or security protocols. But within those caveats was a wide gap between what was absolutely non-shareable and what could be non-shareable. I was caught in a very tricky situation. I couldn't perjure myself or withhold information gained from my employment, but I also couldn't reveal secret information. That's how it was in Secret Service. But I knew that if I kept dodging FBI and Justice Department questions, they'd soon believe I was withholding evidence or even obstructing justice. And if I was overly forthright, I faced prosecution for revealing privileged information. I was dead. Complicating matters even further, our lawyers informed me that they didn't have the same clearance as I did, so I had to be careful about sharing info with them. They weren't deemed need to know for certain procedures involved in my answering their questions. If I felt it necessary to include an explanation of a procedure in my answer, they'd have to be administratively deemed need to know by going to the White House and being given a tour by SAs and UD officers. I couldn't just depend on vetting every potential answer with them first. My head was spinning. My stomach turned. It reminded me of the scene from A Few Good Men. Yes, that scene. "You can't handle the truth," I'd joke. But the truly unfunny joke was that they truly couldn't always legally handle the truth, that is, the facts of my job and what I had witnessed on duty. My ADD and dyslexia didn't help in managing the legal mumbo-jumbo, but this legal stuff was never part of our job description. I wasn't just outflanked, I was outgunned and surrounded. I was a captive, but hopefully still had a fighting chance. The second thing the attorneys and I agreed on was that I had to keep my job. Being a stooge was a non-option, and I knew in my gut that's why Star homed in on me. Someone had ratted me out, but at least I could take solace in its being for a good cause. The FBI hoped I'd reveal their smoking gun, but I couldn't do that without violating protocol. I wouldn't be a stooge. I wanted to keep my word, my integrity, my character, but I needed to tread carefully to ensure that no Clinton, congressional, Justice Department, or Secret Service hardliner packed me off to jail or stripped me of my ability to take care of my family. I had to toe the line enough to keep my job, but I couldn't live with myself or sleep at night if I didn't tell the truth. My conscience, my sleep, my head, and my stomach were going to take a beating for weeks on end while they dragged me through the mud, but I couldn't let myself be racked with doubt, regret, and inner turmoil for the rest of my life. My unborn child was on the way, and I needed to support that child. but I needed to be able one day to look my child in the eye and not only teach, but demonstrate real tough-in-the-clutch honesty. I could have relied on "I don't recall" or "I don't remember," but I would have been a liar. Plausible deniability is talk I reserve for criminals. I wouldn't stoop to the Clintons' level to protect myself. I wouldn't have been any better than they were. It was my epiphany. They couldn't jail me for telling the truth and doing the right thing. I repeated this to myself. It became my inner motto. I needed worthy of trust and confidence to mean something. The service's attorneys assured me that I couldn't be fired for telling the truth when subpoenaed. But doing the right thing meant doing. Doing the right thing would never be doing nothing. After that first week, the SS attorneys started asking. I started telling. Since they were representing the Secret Service, I didn't have to tiptoe so much. But as they made clear in the first week, I didn't have to tell them, nor did they want to know, anything they didn't ask. And as I mentioned, I couldn't readily vet my questions with them. Whatever I told them was trial evidence and to be shared with Starr. But if the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Secret Service didn't think to ask, I didn't have to tell. And that was fine by me. If you had told me in 1995 that it would be a mistress that would politically assassinate the Clintons, I would have laughed in your face. The Clintons and their people appeared to be way in over their heads with so many other things. But those internal things never got out. Things that are still classified today or were swept way under the rug. And I won't describe those things because I know they're still classified. While this situation was overwhelmingly confusing, country still came first. And I'd never let my enemies take that from me. The headline read, "Star Zeroes In on Secret Service Guard." The story said, "The independent counsel cited Gary Byrne by name in his motion to compel his testimony. The hope is that Byrne could shed some light on what led to Monica Lewinsky's dismissal as a White House intern. A former Secret Service officer, Lewis Fox, told investigators Byrne was concerned about the intern's visits to the Oval Office. On the day before Lewinsky was told of her dismissal, Byrne spoke with Deputy White House Chief of Staff Evelyn Lieberman about the intern. Starr wants Byrne to tell a grand jury why he went to Lieberman. For her part, Lieberman says she doesn't recall details of the meeting." Shit. I liked Evelyn a lot, but the pressure had gotten to her. It had been she and I against Monica and President Clinton when we had tried to kick Monica out. But when I saw that headline, it was my word against all of theirs. I phoned a friend I'll call Mark H., a legal heavyweight and former legal counsel for the CIA and for Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter. He now worked at a private D.C. firm. I called him from a payphone, revealing little, but he was interested in my situation and scheduled a meeting. As crazy as all this was for me, this was right in Mark's ballpark. We quickly established my absolutes. I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to keep my job. I didn't view those terms as being at odds. Mark wanted in. This was the stuff of lawyers' dreams, his a few good men moment. His firm would work pro bono, but should the government ever reimburse for their legal fees, they'd file for them. That was fine with me. I knew how lucky I was. Many of my colleagues were on the hook for their own legal expenses, which ran to upwards of $350 per hour. It ruined them financially. That's part of the damage the Clintons callously inflicted on the men and women sworn to lay down their lives to protect them. The Clintons knew that on meager Secret Service salaries, they could never legally afford to challenge them, to reveal their secrets. Financially strapped and fearful of retribution, White House personnel found it sensible to fall back on a convenient, "I don't recall." Since the Secret Service lawyers were from the Justice Department, I had a feeling that some of them were playing double or triple agent. "They're all fed from the same trough," was the political saying. I wanted a heavyweight loyal to me. Mark H. may have saved my life. Yes, I got bogged down in the details and started wringing my hands as my stomach felt as though it would crawl its way out. As much as I liked Mark, I wanted to back out and put my faith in the service and God. Was it even legal for me to have independent counsel? I'm just a cop. Cops sign up for the action, not the legal aftermath, and it blindsides us every time. This was no Air Force DUI bust. This was an impeachable offense against the President of the United States for perjury, bribery, sexual harassment, paying a mistress, and risking national security intelligence. Then there was trying him in the court of public opinion for being a coward, a scoundrel, a womanizer, sexist, and playing political poker at the entire world's expense for his personal pleasure. My emotions reached the bursting point. Mark, seeing me in my wrecked state, had the decency and sense to phone his firm's constitutional expert in Atlanta. This guy knew his shit front to back, every possible Supreme Court interpretation. His manner reassured me. The Constitution was still my Constitution, the one I'd sworn to protect. I could rely on the protections under the Bill of Rights. I needed to know that I still had my right to be a part of Paula Jones' case, to petition the government for a redress of grievances, to use my freedom of speech, my right not to incriminate myself, my right to independent legal counsel, my right against unlawful and unreasonable search and seizure of my property, to privacy, to due process, and to all the others. I was a born-again man who'd taken an oath in defending and upholding the Constitution and the country. Now, that Constitution would defend me. After all, it was the President who took an oath to faithfully execute the office of President of the United States, and, to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. I took a similar oath at the Air Force and the service to protect and defend the Constitution and follow the orders of the President. I kept telling myself, "Do the right thing, Gary. They can't jail you for telling the truth. You are a good man. That means something. You are and will be worthy of trust and confidence." In Mark's office that day, I was still choking up. My eyes welled with tears. I clenched my hands, then clenched them again. My face reddened. I would push on. We'd get through this. Mark and his constitutional expert did me one better. We were getting fired up. I listened in as Mark arranged a conference call between himself, the constitutional expert, and Gary Grindler, the Justice Department honcho Janet Reno had appointed as the Secret Service's counterweight to Ken Starr. Mark ordered me to keep silent. Hell, I couldn't have spoken even if I had wanted to. Was it legal for me to obtain independent personal legal counsel? I was going to get the answer right from the horse's mouth. The expert and Grindler had known each other from college. Small world. "Hey, Gary, Grindler, it's the expert. How are you?" "Hey, so-and-so, I'm fine," says Grindler. "Good, good. Listen, I've got a Secret Service guy here with me who's involved in your little case, and he's seeking independent counsel. I'm calling you as a courtesy to let you know we're representing him, but I'm not obligated to say who, and he's not obligated to say he has independent counsel. But we're representing him nonetheless. That fine with you?" Well enough, yeah. It's probably a good idea to get independent counsel." "Sure. Why not? I would." "You have no issue with it?" "No, I got no issue with it." "Great. Yeah. Okay, see you, Gary. Bye-bye." And that was it. I choked up again. This was really happening. Someone had my back. Mark was outside the Clinton sphere of influence, outside of their web. His firm wasn't the service. It wasn't the feds. They weren't political. They were independent, for-profit, capitalist heavyweights, and I believed that they wanted to do the right thing for a law enforcement officer. They also wanted in on one of the biggest legal cases in history, and I couldn't blame them for that. People speculated that this case could overthrow the president. Mark was my protector. It meant the world to me. The Treasury Department, the Secret Service's boss, had evoked, hell, it was more like they created it out of thin air, what they called the Presidential Protective Function Privilege. It meant that protectors, specifically Secret Service officers, could not rat on their protectees. It was the extrapolation of case law, a privilege, not even a right under the Constitution, that a protection detail formed a marriage of sorts. The idea was, if the service ratted on its protectees, the protectees couldn't trust the service and would duck them. The service couldn't protect an uncooperative protectee, but that doesn't mean the service has to collude with misbehavior. Still, the Treasury Department evoked the Presidential Protective Function Privilege, knowing full well it wouldn't work. I suspected it was part of Mrs. Clinton's just-get-it-done leadership style. She didn't care how, didn't know if it would even work, and didn't get personally involved. She prided herself on plausible deniability, which is how she and her husband gained the presidency by ducking their scandals in Arkansas. But the service and Clinton's defense wasn't remotely plausible. We knew better because we had seen the incidents in question, and somehow Starr discovered who exactly knew what and whom he could squeeze. But deny, deny, deny was turning into drag, drag, drag. Eventually, those pesky FBI agents and reporters would just be worn down over time. So they thought. Sound familiar? Why change the playbook if it worked? Therefore, presidential protectors couldn't be compelled to testify if they chose not to. No one ever asked me if I would. It was assumed I wouldn't testify. Such was the Secret Service way. If the privilege was upheld and I wanted to testify, I would be sticking my neck out, and I'd be the only one. One way or another, this side or the other, I'd be a dead man. The Clintons directed others to lie for them, never in writing, as far as I knew, but I had seen lying firsthand. Their culture of corruption had pushed me out of my post and eventually from the White House. I feared it would push me from the service as well. Many in the service just said, "I don't remember, I'm not sure, I don't recall," or "I can neither confirm nor deny," or they obstructed justice by constantly standing by privileged information. The spirit was to protect the president and protect the service. I couldn't do that, but I still had to tread carefully. "They can't jail me for telling the truth," I kept repeating to myself. In mid-January 1999, prior to my subpoena, and unbeknownst to me while I was at JJRTC, Monica Lewinsky had signed an affidavit, a sworn statement, about her affair. In a Pentagon City, Virginia hotel, Monica also handed Linda Tripp, her Pentagon staffer pen pal, a document, points to make in an affidavit, detailing what to say on an affidavit so as to protect Clinton from charges of sexual harassment made by White House volunteer aide Kathleen Willey. Where that document originated is a mystery. But it was amateur hour for Monica, as usual. Monica and President Clinton had been subpoenaed by the Paula Jones lawyers, and both swore in a public civil case, under penalty of perjury, an impeachable offense for the president, that they did not have a sexual relationship. The Clintons and Monica didn't know it, but Linda Tripp was no Clintonite. She was feeding information on them all to Newsweek and to Ken Starr. Tripp had the affidavit document proving conspiracy, and Starr had his carte blanche. Janet Reno signed off on the Justice Department and FBI expanding their investigations from the Whitewater scandal, in which their main witness, Jim McDougal, mysteriously died, into conspiracy and perjury in Paula Jones's sexual harassment case regarding a government employee. Tripp had taped her phone conversations with Monica detailing her affair with the president, how in the Oval Office she gave him oral sex while he was on the phone with ambassadors and with Dick Morris. President Clinton paid for a White House mistress with taxpayer funds and jeopardized national security with her compromisable and corruptible presence in a secure area, all for little more than on-demand oral sex. We thought we knew what was going on. We didn't know the half of it. Tripp somehow manipulated Monica into giving her the infamous blue dress. Nell and I hadn't cleaned up everything. The president had deposited somewhere besides White House towels. The biggest security leak in history was the one that Monica wore into the White House and then strutted out with, right past us. There was no way to spin it. Either the president had mysteriously gone around the White House ejaculating on people's clothing, or he and Monica had a taxpayer-funded affair for which he committed perjury. It also proved what I damn well knew, that Monica was easily manipulated, either by the likes of a higher-up like President Clinton or a lower-down like Linda Tripp. She had no business playing in a high-stakes environment within arm's reach of intelligence of the CIA, the FBI, the State Department, and the Department of Defense. I mean, the spook shit that moved and was approved through the White House was the most sensitive intel in existence. Actionable intel is power. How could anyone in the Secret Service be expected to do his or her job if the Americans allowed people like the Clintons to assume national leadership? People still think the Lewinsky affair was one political party making a big deal over a little extra pie on the side. It wasn't. What Starr proved was that the president had engaged in inappropriate sexually related workplace conduct with an intern/employee, as he had with other women. Some women, such as Juanita Broderick, even alleged he had assaulted them. He had zero integrity in this area, and that made everything he did suspect and untrustworthy. It revealed his real character. The President of the United States believed that he was above the law. He perjured himself and convinced others to perjure themselves to try to save his carefully crafted image. He created a spirit of corruption that infected the White House, the Secret Service, the whole government. Bill Clinton endangered us all by serving himself. He dragged me through the mud for it. He raked a lot of people over the coals for it. Don't shit where you eat. Don't harass and screw interns and staff for the same reason. If someone can't see how they jeopardize the mission by not being able to see past temptation, they aren't fit for the job. I heard my old TI's mottos, the little mistakes get the wrong people killed. At any moment, the Clintons could have stopped each scandal. They could have told the truth about his affair with Monica. They didn't. They kept pushing and peddling. Monica was young, inexperienced, and immature. The Clintons weren't. They were just immensely arrogant. They told us explicitly that they weren't used to hearing no. Tripp manipulated Monica, but Monica herself had manipulated her way to the president as much as the president schemed to ensnare her. I'd seen it all, or at least enough. But Monica was a pretty, spoiled girl. The president wasn't. He knew damn well what he was doing to her emotionally and physically, and to her reputation. He couldn't have cared less. People like Monica and the entire Clinton machine should never have had access to classified national security-related intelligence or enjoyed leadership positions. Their irresponsibility had consequences. Good men died from it, both in Mogadishu and Benghazi. We had friends die from exhaustion or from falling asleep at the wheel while ensuring the Secret Service mission of protecting the president. To die for a man of character, I can live with that. Scott John Batista got shot to protect the president. Everyone watched the Clinton scandal shit show play out in Congress, in the media, and in the Oval Office, and every night in America's living rooms. All the Clinton successes can be credited to men and women of character, like Leon Panetta, Nancy Hernreich, and Betty Curry. The Clintons' failures all point to themselves. The president and Mrs. Clinton were purely business partners. I believe from their movements and interactions that Mrs. Clinton knew of the affairs. But I do believe she was surprised by her partners stooping to romancing someone the age of their daughter and was furious that he besmirched the brand. Politically, it was unthinkable. How could anyone excuse his womanizing and workplace conduct? I was drowning in the BS and couldn't see clearly. Walking into the Star Investigations office for our FBI UD meetings, I took a deep breath. It was contentious from the outset. They asked the same questions the Secret Service's attorneys asked. I told them exactly what I legally could. But they wanted all the details. They were certain I knew more and was holding back. They wanted the smoking gun. It went on for days. Finely dressed suits grilled me and accused me of corruption. After each session, I trudged to Mark's office. His role defending me was strictly hush-hush, and he did not accompany me to Star's offices, rehashing everything once more. Back home, I would just pass out, leaving Jenny with little support. The BS wore me down. I didn't want to put it on her shoulders. She had enough to carry with our first child. It wasn't right. Suddenly, I realized this must be what Vince Foster felt like. No escape except one. I never felt as if I had no way out, nor did suicide ever cross my mind. But I was overcome by desperation. It's painful to remember everything even now. I reminded myself of what I still had, what I believed in. But my paranoia festered. This wasn't a fair fight. I felt surrounded. A couple of nights I couldn't sleep, so I placed myself on the couch directly facing the door with my sidearm loaded, a round chambered, ready at the slightest sound to draw and fight. That's what it took to get to sleep at times. Each day, my feeling of no sanctuary, no reprieve, grew. No husband or father wants to feel as though he's putting a target on his family, or that his job could compromise their well-being. We discussed some security measures, and I told her that if I ever gave her a call to leave, where she was to go, and how I'd meet her there. If the Clintons had just told the truth, my wife wouldn't have had to suffer this torture. Why did they have to operate like this? Each day, the FBI JD squeezed me between a rock and hard place. I couldn't reveal any confidential intel, but still tried to answer their questions as best I could. In a small, glass-paneled office at the Star Investigation headquarters, things started to get out of hand. "Read him his rights," yelled the investigator. I was being arrested. "Are you effing kidding me?" I yelled in disbelief. "You have the right to remain silent." An FBI agent read me my Miranda rights, but they didn't care if Gary Byrne lived or died. That was clear. Shouting erupted. More Secret Service lawyers rushed in. One pulled me out of the room as the agent and I got in each other's faces. Outside, a Secret Service attorney calmed me down as he explained that they weren't going to let the FBI arrest me. But in the same breath, he told me that if the FBI wanted to, the service couldn't legally impede them. Some reassurance. The issue? Nobody could understand how Monica got past me, the president's uniformed gatekeeper. Duh, because the staff kept aiding and abetting her, and because the president wanted her there. That last part I couldn't legally say. It was privileged. And every detail had to be mulled over. Well, how did you know Monica was paid or unpaid? Because she had an intern pass, and then, after I recommended she be removed, she appeared back in the White House with a blue pass indicating she was a sanctioned West Wing staffer. Any mention of the president was illegal. Days later, the bastards did it again. The same agent yelled in my face, "I will come to your house and arrest you in front of your pregnant wife." I bolted up and slammed the table. We leaned in across the table separating us, ready to pounce. It was about to tip over, if I didn't lurch over it first. "F you! I don't have to take this shit from you!" I yelled, and everyone started shouting again. Each word drew us physically closer. The service attorney grabbed my arm, pushing me out of the room as others poured in, and the agent and I were still yelling. Every word from that agent destroyed my ability to process. If the attorneys couldn't keep us apart, we were going across that table and settle it like old school cops. Gary Grindler might as well have kicked down each door as he stormed into the office. It was just him, the star guys, and that FBI agent. The office was soundproof, but I saw it all through the glass. Grindler took a verbal axe to those assholes. He got his point across. They needed to understand that we were all cops. Despite the petty BS, I was no criminal, and they had no right to threaten anyone's family like that. They did it to my subpoenaed colleagues, too. But I made myself another promise. If that FBI agent came at me one more time, we were going to go at it, and I was going to strike first. If I was going to go to jail, I was going to make it worth my while. My blood still boils when I think about it. Grindler came out and sent me home for the night. It was the safe thing to do. My paranoia was justified. Between the FBI's keeping close tabs on me, too close for comfort, and apparently even on Jenny, their intimations of arrest, the services pressuring me not to remember, and rumors of Clinton intimidations, the stress was mounting. I never called my independent counsel from a White House or service phone, and I knew all of the Justice Department attorneys were eating at the same steakhouse, to use a DC term. They were from the same damn office and were excited to throw the book at hardworking cops stuck in the worst situation cops can be in, the kind where we have no g-damn clue or chance to defend ourselves. I loved Mark and his boys like they were my family, but man, I loathe all other lawyers. A well-meaning pal of mine sent a memo to all posts. He was a bit of a computer whiz and thought it was in good taste. The facts read, Gary J. Byrne is being transferred to Fort Marcy Park, the park where Vince Foster was found dead in a supposed suicide. It was even taped to my locker. Everyone laughed, but behind the laughter was a lump in my throat. I saw firsthand how the first couple had lied, demeaned, and manipulated in such an arrogant and gutless fashion. But could they actually be behind so many of the suspicious or merely coincidental deaths surrounding their activities? Had they really killed Vince Foster? Was it even possible? It weighed on me. Every cop knows how to get away with murder, but cops are supposed to be above being targeted. Even the mere perception of it was frightening. Jenny tried reassuring me. Don't worry, Homer, our beagle, will protect me. That didn't help. I thought, effing great, it's even on my wife's mind. I couldn't get the words of numerous Arkansas troopers and PPD agents out of my mind. They all looked me right in the eye and used the word ruthless. I kept hearing, Gary, everything you hear about them is true. The only thing I could do was commit to a personal operational security regimen. With the heat increasing, I started making plans for what to do if my brake line were cut, or someone tried to run me off the road, or if someone tried sneaking something into a beverage. I started planning in case Jenny and I had to disappear and go off-grid. It was my word, and my word only, against the most powerful people in the world. I'd seen them lie and intimidate. It wasn't a stretch to think that things might escalate. I knew what I was fighting. I contacted a friend, Richard, who had some rural property in north central Potter County, Pennsylvania, known officially as God's Country. He was a doctor in Philadelphia, and he'd saved my mother's life from a dangerous tumor. His family was well known to mine. My mother and father had gratefully promised him and his wife a White House tour. Of course, they hadn't consulted me first. That happens to everyone working at the White House. Despite being overworked and exhausted around the holiday season, I begrudgingly gave the doctor's family the tour. Their little stroller-bound kid, one who'd grow up to be a fine man, threw a small stuffed animal onto the White House lawn. ERT freaked and nearly called in the bomb squad. It was now 1998, and the weight of the Clinton circus fueled my anger and paranoia. I confided in Richard that I was in a jam and needed to get out of Dodge. I didn't provide him with any details, and what was great was that he didn't ask for any. not even when I asked him if Jenny and I could use his property if I had to disappear. "Just go, and don't stop for anything if I tell you to go there," I told her, something no Leo should have to tell their spouse, particularly a pregnant one. Around this time, the world finally learned about Monica's blue dress. To this day, I believe that that DNA-soiled dress saved my life. Monica had worn it on February 28, 1997, during one of her many mentoring sessions. After I had recommended to Evelyn that Monica be removed from the White House, Monica became friends with White House employee Linda Tripp. Had I never recommended to Evelyn Lieberman that Monica needed to leave, Monica would have never met Linda. Tripp hated the Clintons for reasons I can only guess. Monica had preserved the stained dress as a souvenir and confided this to Linda. Linda, who had already contacted reporter Michael Isakoff at Newsweek, manipulated Monica not to dry clean the dress and to hide it in Linda's care for Monica's protection in case the Clintons ever smeared and demeaned Monica, as they had Paula Jones and other victims of Bill's sexual adventures. Linda then passed the dress on to the FBI. Hook, line, sinker. They used that dress to force Monica to sign for an FBI immunity from prosecution from the FBI to testify against Bill Clinton. Later, my lieutenant came up to me. I told him, "I'm doing fine." He wasn't buying it and could tell I was at wit's end. On top of everything else, I was even losing badly needed overtime assignments. I was strapped emotionally and financially. I really needed to get away. He gave it some thought and said, "Gary, here's what I want you to do. I'll work on the OT, no promises. I want you to leave a number, some number where only I can reach you. Take your wife. Go on vacation somewhere where no one can find you, not your usual hangout spot, but where only I can reach you with that number. Got me?" he said. Jenny, Homer, and I absconded to a nearby yet remote lake in Maryland. I hitched my jet ski-laden trailer to the car and peeled out on the highway with pedal to the metal. One sleepless night, I watched Geraldo Rivera talking about me on national television. I just knew my 2 weeks of jet ski freedom were about to be cut short. Sure enough, the next morning I got the call. "I'm so sorry, but we're going to have to bring you back in. How soon can you be at SSHQ? It wasn't an actual question. If I wasn't back in 12 hours, I was told, I'd be in jail.